Today I would like to give the first of a 10-part series on the book of 3 John. Well, I would like to, but I'm not going to. A pastor known for his lengthy sermons noticed a man get up and leave during the middle of his message. The man returned just before the conclusion of the service. Afterwards, the pastor asked the man where he had gone. He said, "I went to get a haircut." "But," said the pastor, "why didn't you do that before the service?" "Because," the gentleman said, "I didn't need one then." Now, this may be a lengthy sermon today by that man's standards, but I hope that you will be able to bear it and that no one will pop out on the Sabbath for a haircut. The title of the sermon today is "The Strangers That Are Among You." And whenever we think about end-time events, we so often turn to Matthew 24. This is where Jesus talks about the signs of the times and the end of the age, in verses 3 to 14. Then, in the following verses, there is much more about Christ's second coming. But we can, and we do focus on these things because they are pivotal in what will happen just prior to Christ's return. When I started attending church in 1973, almost every week we seemed to have a sermon on Matthew 24. It was almost as if you open your Bible and it opened at Matthew 24. We don't seem to do that so much now, and I think we were probably a little unbalanced then. But today I want to look at just one other area that we have covered previously, but perhaps don't think about it so specifically in terms of events at the end time. This is the area of the strangers or the aliens that are among you. Now, I realize that this, if I gave this outside the confines of the Church of God, would be considered politically incorrect. But I'm talking to the people of God, not to people outside. But first of all, I want to make a statement that what I'm going to say today is not to cause any shred of hatred or ill will whatsoever towards anyone. We have to remember that Israel were strangers in another land, although, of course, they had been chosen by God for a purpose and were given the truth, not some pagan philosophy. In addition, the Bible clearly instructs us on how to treat the strangers amongst us, and I will cover that later. And most importantly of all, those strangers amongst us with foreign religions, remember this, will one day have their opportunity for salvation when it is time for their calling. I make these initial observations so that no one can accuse me of stirring up any racial hatred whatsoever. I will quote what God says on this matter. We must always remember that God has his master plan of salvation for all people, not just the people being called today. And that means all people. Everyone will have their chance, as we understand from the doctrine about the Great White Throne Judgment. And so our attitude must be right on this sensitive subject. Now, I want to make these points so that I cannot be misquoted, misunderstood, or misinterpreted, although if somebody wants to do that, they will. And so, do we have the stranger amongst us? I wrote the member letter in December last year where this was addressed. Let me quote from that letter. I said, "Let us just look at what is happening in the United Kingdom today. Whilst I am writing primarily about my own country, the same will apply to all the Israelitish nations as well, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa and the USA, as well as to many other nations. At the end of October 2009, it was reported that Andrew Neather, a former advisor to Tony Blair, Jack Straw and David Blunkett, claimed that the huge increase in migrants over the last decade were partly due to a politically motivated attempt by ministers to radically change the country and rub the right's nose in diversity. He said Labour's relaxation of controls in 2000 and 2001 was a deliberate plan to open up the UK to mass migration, but that ministers were nervous and reluctant to discuss such a move publicly for fear it would alienate its core working class vote. This was strenuously denied. I mean, would you expect anything else? But here was someone at the heart of government telling us what he saw happening. As a result, the public argument from immigration concentrated instead on the economic benefits and need for more migrants. I continued in this letter, whoever was right in this argument, there is no denying that mass immigration has changed the landscape of the UK. We know from the book of Hosea that these things will happen at the end of this age to the British. I then go on to quote Hosea 7, and I'll come back to that in a moment. Perhaps you could be turning there in readiness to Hosea 7. Then I continue in quoting from this member letter, the British have bent over backwards to accommodate foreign religions, even to the detriment of its Judeo-Christian heritage, and now the aliens or strangers amongst us have devoured us. We can read about the proliferation of groves and shrines to Baal and false gods in the Old Testament and how displeased God was with such behaviour. And yet the same thing has happened in our nations today, where modern day groves and shrines are in evidence up and down the land. And as ancient Israel and Judah didn't rid themselves of these idolatrous places, we today are in exactly the same position, where our leaders, both political and religious, allow and promote such practices, which is now a multi-faith society. God insisted on a one-faith nation, as we should enjoy now. Israel and Judah failed in that regard, as indeed we have failed today, with the result that the alien has devoured us and our strength. And that was the end of those comments that I made in that letter. I would just re-emphasise that what I did say was that I'm speaking about my own country, Great Britain, but this will apply to the Israelite nations today and will include Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, and of course the United States of America. The strangers among us can have many influences on our society, and so I want to cover a number of these points where such influence is to our detriment. First and most importantly of all, and I'll spend probably most time on, is the influence of foreign and false religion. So point number one is the influence of foreign and false religion. So that takes us nicely back to Hosea 7. If you've already turned there, Hosea 7, let's read verses 8 and 9, where we read the following. Hosea 7, verse 8. It says, Ephraim, we've always understood that to be the United Kingdom, has mixed herself among the peoples, multiracial, multireligious society. Ephraim is a cake unturned, that is, half-baked. And the King James commentary makes these observations. It says, Ephraim, he has mixed himself among the people. Israel, addressed in the name of its most prominent tribe, is reminded of the mission for which God called it into existence and the destiny that God had promised. Instead, they mixed themselves among the people and adopted their ways. They had much religious activity, but no religious reality. The figure of the cake not turned is most appropriate. As far as religious activity is concerned, they are overdone. But so far as their attitude and reality towards God is concerned, they are raw. Ephraim is a cake not turned. The cake mentioned was baked on hot stones and was something like our pancake. It was easy for it to be burned on one side while being yet raw on the other. The figure fits Israel's condition perfectly. And that's the end of those comments about verse 8. Verse 9. Aliens or strangers have devoured his strength, but he does not know it. Yes, grey hairs are here and there on him, yet he does not know it. Other translations say the following. The Bible in basic English say, men from other lands have made waste his strength and he is not conscious of it. Young's literal translation says, devoured have strangers his power and he hath not known. And then again, the foreigners sap his strength. That's the NIV and God's Word at translation 95. Worshipping foreign gods has sapped their strength, but they don't even know it. That's the New Living Translation. Most translations seem to have used the word strangers, but of course aliens is also one of the words that is used. Devour seems to be reference to eating them up, implications about devouring or overcoming from the inside. Again, the King James commentary says, strangers have devoured his strength and he knew it not. The tragedy of all of this is that Israel did not even know its own condition. Israel had been robbed of her strength and was in a state of decay, but it was totally ignorant of it all. Unger's Bible Dictionary states that the groves were generally found connected with temples. High places were localities chosen as places of worship. They were features of Canaanite religion, and the conquering Israelites were commanded to destroy them when they entered Canaan. Being defiled by Canaanite fertility cults and other paganistic pollutions, the high places were often connected with licentiousness. And they quote Hosea 4 verse 11 to 14. Let's just turn over there. Hosea 4 verse 11. The subheading is the idolatry of Israel. Hosea 4 verse 11 says, harlotry, wine, and new wine enslave the heart. And of course, consequently, this can cause people to turn from God. Verse 12, my people ask counsel from their wooden idols, and their staff informs them. The margin says, the diviner's rod. For the spirit of harlotry has caused them to stray, and they have played the harlot against their God. They offer sacrifices on the mountaintops and burn incense on the hills, under oaks, poplars, and terebinths, because their shade is good. Therefore, your daughters commit harlotry and your brides commit adultery. I will not, I believe that should be, shall I not, punish your daughters when they commit harlotry, nor your brides when they commit adultery. For the men themselves go apart with harlots, and offer sacrifices with a ritual harlot. Therefore, people who do not understand will be trampled. Now, you might want to make a note to look at later of Isaiah 1 verse 7, which also talks about strangers devouring your land in your presence. Of course, we have to realize that without the influx of aliens, illegal or otherwise, our so-called Christian churches have taught so many things that are wrong and contrary to the clear teachings of the Bible. In effect, we already had our own groves and places of wrong worship without importing or allowing overtly wrong religion into our country. We didn't need any help in that respect. We used to have a veneer, however slim that was, of Christianity, but that has now been sidelined, is now considered an irrelevance in what is now considered to be an enlightened society. What a state of affairs. How many times did God tell ancient Israel to get rid of the groves and high places in the Old Testament? Let's have a look at a few examples, starting with Exodus 34, verses 12 to 17. This is where God gave them clear direction. There's no argument here. Exodus 34, starting in verse 12, says, take heed to yourself, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land where you are going, lest it be a snare in your midst. But you shall destroy their altars, break their sacred pillars, and cut down their wooden images. For you shall worship no other God, for the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. Lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they play the harlot with their gods, and make sacrifice to their gods, and one of them invites you, and you eat of his sacrifice. And you take of his daughters for your sons, and his daughters play the harlot with their gods, and make your sons play the harlot with their gods. You shall make no molded gods for yourself. I mean, this clearly highlights the potential risk that they faced with false religion. If you turn to Numbers 33, verses 50 to 52, again, they are given instructions for the conquest of Canaan. Numbers 33, starting in verse 50. Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you have crossed the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you. Destroy all their engraved stones, destroy all their moulded images, and destroy all their high places. Now that, to me, is pretty simple to understand and pretty straightforward. And in Deuteronomy 33, verse 29, if you turn there, we see further instructions. This is part of Moses' final blessing on Israel, as the chapter heading reads. Deuteronomy 33, verse 29 says, "Happy are you, O Israel. Who is like you, a people saved by the Lord, the shield of your help and the sword of your majesty? Your enemies shall submit to you, and you shall tread down their high places." They were told to tread down the high places, places of false worship, but we know that the Israel's dedication to God went up and down like a donkey's tail. First it was good, then it wasn't. Then it was good, then it wasn't. After about 25 years after the death of Joshua, yet again they went off the rails. If you'll turn to Judges 2, verse 8, which refers to Joshua's death. Judges 2, verse 8. This reads, Joshua 2, verse 8 says, "Now Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died when he was 110 years old." Then in verses 11, 12 and 13 we read, "Then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals, and they forsook the Lord God of their fathers who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them, and they bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. They forsook the Lord and served Baal and the Ashtoreths." You see, it didn't take long for bad habits to rise to the fore once again. I read that one commentator said that the phrase, "and they did evil in the sight of the Lord," is used 44 times in the Bible and was always followed by punishment. This phrase is mentioned in verse 11, and just three verses later comes the punishment. Verse 14 says, "And the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, so he delivered them into the hands of plunderers who despoiled them, and he sold them into the hands of their enemies all around, so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Wherever they went out, the hand of the Lord was against them for calamity, as the Lord had said, and as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were greatly distressed." And if you'll turn to Psalm 106, we read again about the sins of Israel. We don't have shortages of references here. If you'll turn over to Psalm 106 and let us read verses 34 to 43. Here we see the problems that Israel created by not doing as God commanded. Psalm 106, starting in verse 34. "They did not destroy the peoples concerning whom the Lord had commanded them, but they mingled with the Gentiles and learned their works. They served their idols, which became a snare to them. They even sacrificed their sons and their daughters to demons. They shed innocent blood, the blood of their sons and daughters, whom they sacrificed to the idols of Canaan, and the land was polluted with blood. Thus they were defiled by their own works, and played the harlot by their own deeds. Therefore the wrath of the Lord was kindled against his people, so that he abhorred his own inheritance. And he gave them into the hand of the Gentiles, and those who hated them ruled over them. Their enemies also oppressed them, and they were brought into subjection under their hand. Many times he delivered them, but they rebelled in their counsel, and were brought low for their iniquity." Now there are so many references in the Old Testament that we could turn to that clearly reveal to us that God, what God thinks about such practices. God wanted them to remain faithful to him and get rid of foreign and false gods. Applying this same modus operandi to what is happening in our nation today, and as I say, I'm primarily talking about the United Kingdom, but it applies just as much to the United States and Canada, that we have in the UK around 1,000 mosques. These are high places and groves. These are places of false worship, which is part of Islam, which is a false religion. And therefore, anyone who may listen to this sermon on the internet or gets hold of a copy of this message and squeals about discrimination and lack of respect to another religion, let me quote what God says on this matter, and then let any individuals argue with God, not with me. Turn to, please, to Acts 4, verses 10 and 12. This is part of the story when Peter and John were arrested and Peter addressed the Sanhedrin. Acts 4, in verse 10. Let it be known to you all and to all the people of Israel, but by the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth, whom you crucified, whom God raised from the dead, by him this man stands here before you whole. This is the stone which was rejected by you builders, which has become the chief cornerstone. Nor is there salvation in any other, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. And so the Bible states that the only name under heaven given by which we can be saved is that of Jesus Christ. It's not Muhammad, it's not Buddha, it's not Krishna. It's no one but Christ, if you believe the Bible. And we in the true Church of God do believe the Bible. And so for us, there is absolutely no argument on this issue whatsoever. The Church of England church that I attended as a teenager is now a Sikh centre. People have time off for Ramadan. Women go to work covered with just their eyes showing, and if this is then objected to, then court action by the aggrieved, in inverted commas, party can ultimately follow. Every religion is afforded the same status in the eyes of the law. I could quote many cases that are regularly reported where Christians, in inverted commas, are marginalised by the state, usually through legislation about equal rights, human rights, and so on. Britain, if it ever was a Christian nation, is certainly not one today. From the point of religion, the stranger amongst us has certainly had a dramatic impact and weakened our Judeo-Christian heritage. Just before I left, someone wrote me a letter, which I received at the office, and he said, and let me just read this, he said, with different nations or people invading the UK, bringing their own religions and laws, etc., it was always bound to bring great problems into being. Many UK natives are taking up the ways of the incomers, even changing their religions, intermarrying, etc. Our God tells us not to take up nor follow their ways. Our God is testing the whole world, whilst the evil one and his own continue to lead people into terrible temptations and sins. The authorities are stretched to breaking point with the influx of incomers to this small, limited island, causing more unrest and trouble. That's just somebody that wrote into the office who got a good grasp of what was going on. So that's point number one. The point number two is that of the effects of immigration on demographics. So the stranger or aliens amongst us have effects this way, the effect of immigration on demographics. Now, all the politicians in the UK that I have heard on this matter have always stated, without fail, that they believe that a multicultural, multi-religious society is a good thing. I have never heard any politician, perhaps except some extremists, who would say otherwise. And if they did, they would no doubt be pilloried. They would probably be branded as racist, intolerant, bigoted, prejudiced, small-minded, narrow-minded, or even fanatical. Such is the state of play in our nations today. But what have been the fruits? And that is always a good question to ask. Now, I was sent by email, a video about changing world demographics. I don't know whether any of you saw it. It stated that in order for a culture to maintain itself for more than 25 years, a fertility rate of 2.11 children per family was needed, or that culture would decline. And if that level reached 1.9 children per family, it had never been reversed and would be impossible to reverse if it dropped to 1.3. As the population shrinks, so does the culture. And as just a very quick aside, another reason why, for example, homosexuality is wrong, apart from the obvious, is it's a way of life that produces no children, and a society comprising only of homosexuals would soon cease to exist. Pretty obvious, but worth stating, I think. But that's another story. Currently, England's fertility rate, I think that should have been the UK, is 1.6, and the European Union is just 1.38. But with Islamic immigration, the population of Europe is growing. Still quoting from the video, in France, the rate is 1.8, but with the Islamic families, it is 8.1. And France now had more mosques than churches, and at this rate, France would be an Islamic nation in 39 years. Interestingly, in just a few short years, apparently, 40% of the Russian army will be Muslim. But looking at the Israelite nations, it stated that the Islamic population has grown, and this is in the UK, from 82,000 just 20 years ago to 2.5 million today, a 30-fold increase with, as I say, 1,000 mosques up and down the land. In Canada, the population rate is 1.6, but the Muslim rate is over 2. And from 2001 to 2006, the Canadian population grew by 1.6 million, of which 1.2 million was by immigration. And in the USA here, the current fertility rate is 1.6, but with the Latino immigration, it is 2.11. In 1970, there were 100,000 Muslims in the USA, but by 2008, there were 9 million. Apparently, there was an Islamic conference of over 30 nations that was held in Chicago just 3 years ago that said they must be prepared to evangelize America through journalism, education, and other means to prepare for the 50 million Muslims that the country was expected to have within 30 years. The Catholic Church recently admitted that Islam has now surpassed their numbers. Some studies show that in 5 to 7 years, Islam will be the dominant religion in the world. Interesting information. This attitude truly shows us why God did not want his people mixing with and living amongst false religions, and why he wanted them to remain faithful to him. This influence was a problem thousands of years ago and is a problem today. If you'll turn to Leviticus 17 verse 8, and whilst this is breaking into the context about offering a burnt offering or sacrifice, it still makes an important point. So let us read this verse. Leviticus 17 verse 8 says, "Also you shall say to them, whatever man of the house of Israel or of the strangers who dwell among you who offers a burnt offering or sacrifice." Now, did you catch that? It states, whatever man of the house of Israel or of the strangers who dwell among you, clearly showing that strangers who dwelt amongst the Israelites integrated themselves into that society. That's the implication of that verse. As strangers should do in our country today, but mostly they don't. This same principle is shown in Leviticus 24, verse 16. If you turn to Leviticus 24, verse 16. It says, "And whoever blasphemes the name of the Lord shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall certainly stone him, the stranger as well as him who is born in the land. When he blasphemes the name of the Lord, he shall be put to death." Again, this principle of involvement in the affairs of the nation by strangers is emphasized. Involvement, however, is different from senior leadership positions. Deuteronomy 17 verse 15, if you'll turn there, shows clearly this differentiation. Deuteronomy 17 verse 15. It says, "When you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you, and possess it, and dwell in it, and say, I will set a king over me like the nations that are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. This is about setting foreigners over the local population. We know that those in senior leadership positions will press home their own values, or lack of them in some cases. And if the foreigner is from another religion, that could well play a part in his decision-making process. We can see how in the UK this has happened, and we're not unique in this way. In a newspaper article on the 7th of February this year in the Daily Mail, the BBC's head of religion accused the Church of England of living in the past and said that the corporation should not give Christianity preferential treatment. And who is the head of religion? Aqil Ahmed, a Muslim. So there's no surprise there then. The newspaper article continued, Aqil Ahmed, a controversial executive whose appointment last year prompted more than 100 complaints, said, "I think all the faiths should be treated in the same way. I don't believe in treating any faith differently." So now you know. One of the problems we have seen is that of homegrown terrorists, British-born, but ready to cause problems to their own countrymen. The problem is that they have not properly assimilated into British society, but believe that Islam is the answer to everything. In fact, it is the answer to nothing. If British Christians went to Saudi Arabia and tried to build churches and evangelize there, they would be thrown out of the country. At times it seems only to work one way, and God knew the problems that strangers amongst the ancient nation of Israel would cause them. And the same principle applies today, because as we read in Hosea, we expect the aliens or the strangers amongst us at the end time to devour us, and we are in the end time. And so as the strangers amongst us grow, and in the UK we've had them from many parts of the world, those who hold to foreign religions, an increasing number, will reduce the effect that the Judean Christian influence has had historically within the nation, and with disastrous effects. The third area is that of the influence on the law of the land. Influence on the law of the land. Most of the problems that we have seen in this respect has been the influx of Muslims into the UK, and that some of them are now demanding, not asking, not requesting, not suggesting, absolutely demanding the implementation of Sharia law. I'd like to quote from Dr. Peter Hammond's book, Slavery, Terrorism and Islam, The Historical Roots and Contemporary Threat. Dr. Hammond states the following, and this is just a very, very brief extract. He says, and I'm quoting him, "Islam is not just a religion, nor is it a cult. It is a complete system. Islam has religious, legal, political, economic and military components. The religious components cover for all the other components. Islamization occurs when there are sufficient Muslims in a country to agitate for their so-called religious rights. When politically correct and culturally diverse societies agree to the reasonable Muslim demands for their religious rights, they also get the other components under the table. This is how it works. The percentages, is the source is the CIA, the World Factbook, 2007. And again, I'm quoting from his book. As long as the Muslim population remains around 1% of any given country, they will be regarded as a peace-loving minority and not a threat to anyone. In fact, they may be featured in articles and films, stereotyped for their colourful uniqueness." By the way, after each percentage that is mentioned, countries with that percentage are quoted. So they quote the number of people or percentage in each country. But for brevity, I won't quote all of these countries. He says at 2 and 3% they begin to proselytize from other ethnic minorities and disaffected groups, with major recruiting from the jails and among street gangs. From 5% on, they exercise an inordinate influence in proportion to their percentage of the population. They will push for the introduction of halal, clean by Islamic standards, food. thereby securing food preparation jobs for Muslims. They will increase pressure on supermarket chains to feature it on their shelves, along with threats to comply, the United States. At this point, they will work to get the ruling government to allow them to rule themselves under Sharia, the Islamic law. The ultimate goal of Islam is not to convert the world, but to establish Sharia law over the entire world. When Muslims reach 10% of the population, they will increase lawlessness as a means of complaint against their conditions, Paris car burnings. Any Muslim action that offends Islam will result in uprisings and threats, Amsterdam, the Muhammad cartoons. After reaching 20%, expect hair trigger rioting, jihad militia formations, sporadic killings, and church and synagogue burnings. At 40%, you will find widespread massacres, chronic terror attacks, and ongoing militia warfare. From 60%, you may expect unfettered persecution of non-believers and other religions, sporadic ethnic cleansing, genocide, use of Sharia law as a weapon, and jizya, J-I-Z-Y-A, the tax placed on infidels. After 80%, expect state-run ethnic cleansing and genocide. 100% will usher in the peace of Dar es Salaam, the Islamic House of Peace. They're supposed to be peace because everyone is a Muslim. Of course, that's not the case. It is good to remember that in many, many countries, such as France, the Muslim populations are centered around ghettos based on their ethnicity. Muslims do not integrate into the community at large. Therefore, they exercise more power than would normally be expected from their percentage of the population. And that's the end of Dr. Hammond's comments. But one interesting matter that he raised was that at a certain level, the Muslims wanted to be able to rule themselves under Sharia law, in essence, putting themselves at odds with the law of the land in the UK. Now, I focused on Muslims because they seem to be the largest group of strangers that we have in the UK, and the most vocal. We do have strangers from other groups, races and areas, from Africa, the West Indies, Europe, Eastern Europe, but none of them present the same problems that we have with the Muslim influx. Let me quote from Wikipedia what they have to say about Sharia law. They say, and it's brief, in modern English it often refers to an Islamic concept, the wide body of Islamic religious law. Used thus, it refers to the legal framework within which the public and private aspects of life are regulated for those living in a legal system based on Islamic principles of jurisprudence and for Muslims living outside the domain. Sharia deals with many aspects of day-to-day life, including politics, economics, banking, business, contracts, family, sexuality, hygiene, and social issues. Islamic law is now the most widely used religious law and one of the three most common legal systems of the world, alongside common law and civil law. And so, Islamic law is now being demanded by some in our country, the UK, where we have our own legal system. This will not go away and is a case of, when in Rome, not doing as the Romans do, a variation of the old saying. And as we seem to have imported another problem from the stranger that is within us, in the middle of December 2009, we had the case in the UK of a so-called honour killing. At the end of a dramatic and emotional 11-week trial, Mehmet Goran was given a life sentence with a minimum of 22 years for killing his daughter after kidnapping, drugging and tying her up. The newspaper report said that Chule's mother, Hanin, whose testimony against her husband was crucial to the prosecution, was too afraid to attend court for the rest of the trial. Last week, police installed additional security measures in her home and that of her surviving daughter, Nure, also a prosecution witness. Yesterday, Nure praised her mother for testifying. She said, "No one should fail to realise what this means within our culture. These people do not forget." The case marked the first time prosecutors have used expert witnesses in what they call an honour crime. They describe how the system worked among Turkish Kurds and highlighted features of the Goran case, such as the loss of her virginity to her boyfriend, a loss of family honour that triggered the murder, which paralleled similar murders in Turkey. Experts have said that the breach of the code of honour, or namus, that detectives believe led to Tule's killing could also apply when a woman speaks out against her husband. Police believe there are 12 honour killings a year in Britain and a quarter of the victims are under 18. That was the newspaper report. Of course, we have enough problems of our own without letting the strangers bring their weird and shocking approach into our culture. Back in Hosea 8 verse 7, let's just read the first part of this verse, Hosea 8 verse 7. Hosea 8 verse 7 says, "They sow the wind and reap the whirlwind." They sow the wind and reap the whirlwind. The King James Bible commentary states the following: "In their defection they have sown the seeds of their defeat and undoing. However, they will not reap what they have sown, but much worse, the harvest of what they have sown. They have sown a wind, but will reap a hurricane. They will be swept away in the judgment of God, and any benefits that they desired would fall to the hands of strangers to whom God would deliver them." We were warned. We have not heeded God's instruction on this matter, and we will reap the whirlwind. As one commentator wrote, "Everyone recognizes the problems we face in our nation. Few, if any, argue that things are getting better. There is a solution to our dilemma, just as there was for Israel's. But Israel rejected the true solution in favor of quick and easy fixes, which were no fixes at all. They mocked and ridiculed the solution and were destroyed for it." So we better take note. But we won't. So item number four, or point number four, is the influence of strangers in the land economically. The influence of strangers in the land economically. Again, this is yet another area that can truly affect the local population. We in the UK are being inundated from many other countries by strangers trying to get into the UK. They hide in large trailers and vans, and by other means in order to reach what they consider as their promised land. Many are good workers and will work illegally for less than members of the indigenous population, and that is not fair or right on either party. Let me quote from the Daily Express, dated February the 8th, 2010. I've got the newspaper here. It says, immigrants handed 1.3 million jobs. It says, "More than 1.3 million immigrants have been given the right to work and claim benefits in Britain since Gordon Brown promised British jobs for British workers. Damning Whitehall figures revealed last night prove a shattering new blow to Labour's open-door border policies. Official statistics show that a total of 1,370,820 foreigners have been granted national insurance numbers over the last 2 years, and the influx has continued despite hundreds of thousands of British-born workers losing their jobs in the recession and employment rising to 2.46 million. Latest evidence of the collapse of Britain's border controls will be a huge embarrassment to the Prime Minister, and so it should be, following his now discredited vow to put British-born workers first. And it raises fresh questions about Britain being a target for benefits tourism, with concerns that immigrants are using national insurance numbers to get state pensions and other welfare handouts." Which brings me on to the fact that many of the strangers or aliens that are amongst us are housed and fed and given state benefits to which they have never contributed one penny piece. We should always want to help the poor, the underdog, and those who desperately need help, but so many seem to come for what they can prize out of the system. I'm sure you have it over here as well. We had a case of a single mother of eight who received, listen, £90,000 a year, that's about $140,000 a year, in housing allowance so that she could live in a £2.6 million mansion and receive other benefits of £15,000 a year. The previous month, a family of nine from Somali were living in a £1.8 million house in central London, costing £1,600 a week. And a family of eight Afghan immigrants have been housed for the previous 14 months in a £1.2 million house in West London at a cost of £12,000 per month. £168,000 in 14 months, or $250,000. After these were highlighted in late 2009, many other cases came to light. Is it any wonder that our social security budget is creaking loudly under the load, and that many who may have paid income tax and national insurance contributions for many decades get really disillusioned when they can't get a fraction of the help that they need, and yet these strangers amongst us can receive so much from the state? I'm sure that God understood this possibility, this probability, when he said that aliens had devoured his strength, but he does not know it. That's we've read in Hosea 7 verse 9. And our leaders still don't know it, or if they do, they certainly don't acknowledge it. In 2 Thessalonians, if you'll turn there, 3 verses 8 to 10, we read something again very simple. 2 Thessalonians 3 verses 8 to 10. This is Paul's warning against idleness, and whilst it is directed at church members, is a principle applicable to everyone. 2 Thessalonians 3 verse 8 says, "Nor did we eat anyone's bread free of charge, but worked with labour and toil, night and day, that we might not be a burden to any of you. Not because we do not have authority, but to make ourselves an example of how you should follow us." Verse 10. "For even when we were with you, we commanded you this: if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat." The word commanded is a very strong and authoritative word. There is no holding back here. It was appropriate then, and it is appropriate today, and for all, indigenous population and strangers alike. But we have people coming into our country, not working, taking state benefits, and often using human rights legislation to back up their case if their situation is actually queried. This is yet another area where our strength is being reduced as we are being devoured. Just one final comment on this area of the influence financially on our nations, and this one applies specifically to the United States. I was recently sent an email with a stack of information. It was headed, "Why is the USA bankrupt?" It then went on to quote the National Policy Institute, the Center for Immigration Studies, and Homeland Security, plus a number of other sources which revealed that the cost to the USA was $338.3 billion a year through illegal aliens in the country. This is illegal aliens, not the legal aliens. Now, I have a list quoted how it is made up, and I won't quote all of the items, that would take too long, but suffice to say that the alien or stranger among you in the USA is a huge sum of money that is crippling the country financially. And in the USA, truly, the strangers that are among you are devouring you. Point five, the influence of strangers on our business. The influence of strangers on our business. We have allowed many of our businesses and companies to be bought by aliens, foreigners, or strangers that we are not, therefore, masters of our own destiny any longer. We are basically owned by foreigners. I've read that the USA will not let foreigners buy airlines, television networks, or increasingly any business remotely connected with security. France protects 11 sectors from foreign takeovers, including casinos, they should get rid of those anyway, and defence subcontractors. But here's just a flavour of lost British companies. Spanish companies have recently bought O2, the huge British mobile phone operator. Santander now have the Alliance and Leicester Bank, the Bradford and Bingley Bank, and the Abbey Banking Group. They also have the British Airports Authority, which owns and runs London's main airport. So we don't even own our own London airport. They're run by Spanish companies. The French, meanwhile, have at various times acquired UK Power, London Electricity, and water companies, as well as defence businesses such as Shorts, Missile Systems and Raycol Electronics. The Germans have Bentley Cars, Volkswagen, Rolls-Royce, BMW, Mini Cars by BMW, British Auction Company, XL Logistics, and so on. An Indian company now owns Typhoon Tea. Now, that's very important to the British, the tea. Something I hate personally, but there we go. An Egyptian owns Harrods, which is a huge store in London. The Hong Kong Banking Corporation, HSBC, owns the Midland Bank. Rover Cars, first BMW, and now that's Chinese. Most British aluminium producers owned by Alcoa, USA, or Alcan from Canada. Lotus Cars, owned by a Malaysian group. Pilkington Glass, owned by Nippon Sheet Glass of Japan. P&O Ferries, owned by Dubai Port World. And so much more. I've just taken a few of those. So many foreigners have come in, bought up our businesses, and run, basically, our country. That's by no means an exhaustive list, but it does give a flavour of who is buying up our businesses. And it is certainly a way of devouring us economically. Point number six, the effect on identity. The effect on identity. In our update 423, dated 18th of December 2009, we quoted Der Spiegel Online on December the 11th under the heading, How Much Allah Can Europe Bear? As follows. Let me quote from the update. It says, the Swiss decision has shocked Europe and the world because its ramifications go far beyond the building of minarets. They also concern the identity of an entire continent. This was a referendum on Western society's perception of Islam as a threat. The issue is generating intense debate. Just how much of Islam is predominantly Christian Europe prepared to accept? The decision by the otherwise so tolerant Alpine country reveals the deep-seated fear of an Islam that is becoming increasingly visible. Surveys last week revealed that 44% of Germans oppose the construction of minarets, followed by 41% of the French. 55% of all Europeans see Islam as an intolerant religion. Does the Swiss vote reveal an attitude that a majority in Europe would also support if given the opportunity? It asks the question. Can Europe still be Europe if, for instance, in 2050, most young people under the age of 15 in Austria are Muslims? And when Mohammed today is already the most common name for newborn boys in Brussels and Amsterdam, and the third most common in England? End of those comments from our update, quoting Der Spiegel Online. Further, it was reported in September 2008 that a group of Muslim clerics funded by Colonel Gaddafi are set to make appearances at three Midland mosques at the Midlands of England. 11 preachers sponsored by the World Islamic Call Society, WICS, WICS, which was founded, led and paid for by the Libyan leader, will be holding events in Birmingham, Leicester and Nottingham during Ramadan. The speeches come just a month after the release of convicted Lockerbie bomber Abdel Basset Ali al-Megrahi caused a storm between Britain and the US when he returned to a hero's welcome in Tripoli. And in a recent speech, Colonel Gaddafi said that the aim of WICS was to convert the whole of Europe to Islam. He said, "This religion shall overcome all other religions before it. Their time has gone. It is his promise, Allah shall prevail this religion over the rest." There are tens of millions of Muslims in the European continent, and the number is on the increase. The number of indigenous Europeans is falling drastically. This is the clear indication that the European continent will be converted to Islam. Europe will one day be a Muslim continent. And that's the end of those comments. But I also want to quote to you from the Sunday Telegraph very recently. This was the Sunday Telegraph of February the 28th. And it says, Islamic radicals infiltrate Labour, Labour being the main ruling party. A Labour minister says his party has been infiltrated by a fundamentalist Muslim group that wants to create an Islamic social and political order in Britain. The Islamic Forum of Europe, the IFE, which believes in jihad and Sharia law and wants to turn Britain and Europe into an Islamic state, has placed sympathisers in elected office and claims, correctly, to be able to achieve mass mobilisation of voters. Speaking to the Sunday Telegraph, Jim Fitzpatrick, the Environment Minister, said that the IFE had become, in effect, a secret party within Labour and other political parties. They are acting almost as an entryist organisation, placing people within the political parties, recruiting members to these political parties, trying to get individuals selected and elected so they can exercise political influence and power, whether it's at local government or national level, he said. Of course, we understand that Europe will become a Catholic continent, intolerant of any competition. But under this point, I just wanted to mention that identity can be lost, as it has, to quite a degree in the United Kingdom. In January 2010, one UK journalist made these observations. A country of once well-mannered people with strong shared beliefs no longer has confidence in its identity. As a result, many millions of ordinary Brits don't know what their nation stands for anymore. I have lost count of the number of readers who have written to me over the last 6 years I have been writing for this paper to say that they feel no longer a voice in their own country. They feel like strangers in their own land. Quite a telling phrase that from just a secular journalist. It's interesting that the feeling may be more widespread than we may at first think. One well-known English entertainer said that he had emigrated to Dubai in the Middle East. He said that he might as well be a stranger in a foreign land than a stranger in his own. We remember that ancient Israel had an identity that God knitted together through Moses and which was continued with Joshua. But the path would be stormy, as we know, with good and bad kings over a period of time. But Israel and Judah never really lost their national identity, and we trace our roots back to those people. And just about everyone today recognizes the Jews or the tribe of Judah because they're known for keeping the Sabbath. Now that's real national identity, which is important and which we are in severe danger of losing. So point number seven is how to treat strangers. How to treat strangers. God has something to say on this matter and is important for us, not only to understand, to make sure that we abide by these instructions. In Exodus 22, if you'll turn there, verse 21, we read under the heading Moral and Ceremonial Principles the following. Exodus 22, verse 21. It says, "You shall neither mistreat a stranger nor oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt." Matthew Henry's commentary makes the following observations. Humanity is one of the laws of religion and obliges us particularly to be tender of those that lie most under disadvantages and discouragements, and to extend our compassionate concern to strangers and those to whom we are not under the obligations of alliance or acquaintance. Those that are strangers to us are known to God, and he preserves them. And on a few verses in Exodus 23 verse 9, we read a very similar instruction. Exodus 23 verse 9 says, "Also you shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of a stranger, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt." The Israelites were strangers in Egypt for over 400 years. Just think for a moment, if we had been strangers ourselves in another land until now, that would have started in 1610. Just a mind-boggling amount of time. And so, as they had been through such a severe trial, they were not to mistreat others. And just over in Deuteronomy 24, verse 14, as if to make sure that we really take note of this, this is what it says. Deuteronomy 24, verse 14 says, "Also you shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of a stranger, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt." And so we see for a third time what our approach should be. It was a principle then, and it should be a principle now. And just because our government lets in far too many immigrants or strangers doesn't mean that they should be mistreated when they're in our land. Everyone who has not had a chance for salvation will, by God's great mercy and plan, have their first chance either in this life now or during the millennium of Christ's rule or in the great white throne judgment. And so we must not abuse, mistreat or be unkind to any of those who fall into this category. Nevertheless, at the same time, we have to recognize the problems that our governments can create by allowing strangers in the numbers they do, by not insisting that they adopt our ways when they are once in our country. They should not be allowed to come into our land and bring a foreign religion with them, action which God roundly condemns. And so this is just one reason why we as a nation will suffer greatly in the future, and is a part of the prophetic scenario that we don't often spend too much time thinking or talking about. But I would add a very important point, and let us never forget this. We are also strangers in society and the world today, but for a different reason, and our calling is the difference. If you'll turn to Hebrews 11, verses 13 to 16, we read that we are ambassadors for Christ, and an ambassador, as we know, lives in a foreign land. Hebrews 11, verse 13 to 16, we read the following. "These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, were assured of them, embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For those who say such things declare plainly that they seek a homeland. And truly, if they had called to mind that country from which they had come out, they would have had opportunity to return. But now they desire a better, that is, a heavenly country. Therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them." You may remember that I said that I'd read that one commentator said that the phrase, "and they did evil in the sight of the Lord," is used 44 times in the Bible and was always followed by punishment. Our nations have done evil in the sight of the Lord, and our national punishment is coming. Let us again turn to Hosea 7, verses 8 and 9. I want to read finally this once again, Hosea 7, verses 8 and 9. And after what we've heard today, perhaps this might give us greater insight. "Ephraim has mixed himself among the peoples," as we've seen, multiracial, multireligious society. "Ephraim is a cake unturned. Aliens have devoured his strength, but he does not know it. Yes, grey hairs are here and there on him, yet he does not know it. But there is good news ahead." Let us turn to a final piece of scripture today, Hosea 14, starting in verse 1. The subheading is "Israel Restored at Last." Hosea 14, verse 1. It says, "O Israel, return to the Lord your God, for you have stumbled because of your iniquity. Take words with you and return to the Lord. Say to him, take away all iniquity. Receive us graciously, for we will offer the sacrifices of our lips. Assyria shall not save us. We will not ride on horses, nor will we say any more to the work of our hands. You are our gods, for in you the fatherless find mercy. I will heal their backsliding. I will love them freely, for my anger has turned away from him. I will be like the dew to Israel. He shall grow like the lily and lengthen his roots like Lebanon. Those who dwell under his shadow shall return. They shall be revived like grain and grow like a vine. Their scent shall be like the wine of Lebanon. Ephraim shall say, what have I to do any more with idols?" That's obviously completely unlike today, because we say the opposite. What have I to do with idols? I have heard and observed him. I am like a green cypress tree. Your fruit is found in me. Who is wise? Let him understand these things. Who is prudent? Let him know. For the ways of the Lord are right. The righteous walk in them, but transgressors stumble in them.